If you're sitting right next to somebody, there's plenty of space. So at least create one seat between you and the next person. So if you're bunched up, separate. Okay. There's plenty of room. Look, empty rows, entire rows for you. It's like an airplane without anybody on it. No. Okay, so here's what I'm going to do. Those of you who weren't in my corporate finance class, the routine should be pretty straightforward. I will hand the quizzes out face down. Keep them face down, and while they're face down, write your name on the back. Write your name. Don't sign your name. I don't want your autograph. I'll come for it later if you get famous. Write your name on the back. I need to be able to read your name. Okay? So if you have one of those four name Latin American names, make sure you highlight the name that is the last name that Stern keeps you under as well. You know the one I'm talking about now. And especially in Latin America, I'm not sure which middle name I should go to. So just underline, say, this is my last name according to the records, okay? So keep the quizzes down, face down, till everybody has a copy, okay? And for those of you who just came in late, try to separate yourself at least by a seat from the next person so you have plenty of room to spread things out. Okay? Get this going, please. Pass it back. No, you can pass it. I'm going to give you a whole pile. You can just pass it. Just pass it right there. Actually, need a couple more. A whole stack coming back. Yeah. Stack coming back for you.
Are there seats down there?
Yeah, plenty of seats. I'll take it. That's three for you. Forget you. Go sit down first and get you in. Where are you sitting? Yeah, Nick. Oh. Thank you. I like my shirt too. Always do.
Thank you.
Everybody have a quiz? Okay, make sure you write your name on the back. If you have extra quizzes, just dump them. I don't care. You got one? Okay, turn your quiz over. Write your name on the front as well. Make sure it's the same name you wrote on the back. I know that's kind of tricky sometimes. Okay? So before you get started, there are four, don't worry, I'll give you 30 minutes starting with my instructions. There are four questions. They're all equal credit. Mathematically, you know what this means. That it's 23 minutes and you're still on the first question, you're doing the wrong thing. So keep up, at least within, try to maintain some, around 8 minutes, move on. So don't get stuck, because I'd rather that you try all four and that you do them partially than you get that you get one perfectly right. Okay, so you have 30 minutes starting now.
Thank you.
Have attention for just a moment, please. I'm going to add 3 extra minutes to the quiz. This 10% more time, so relax. You know, some of you is going to... The tension is just... about 5 minutes. Time is up. Please write your names on the witness. Hand it for the enemy's job. Let them be over. Thank you. Pranantha. Okay. So for those of you who've those of you who've never taken a quiz with me, this is what's going to happen. Okay? The quizzes are going to get sorted right now alphabetically while we finish the class. And when the class ends, I start grading. And I keep grading till I stop grading. And then I will send an email out saying, your quizzes are graded. Come and pick them up. And the way they will be available to pick up is they will be on the ninth floor of KMEC in the front in three boxes alphabetically sorted. Okay, so you cannot claim you don't know where you are in the alphabet. You should. So no browsing, right? So just pick up your quiz and leave. It'll be face down. That's why I asked you to write the name on the back, right? So just pick up your quiz, walk away. Okay? And then when I send you the email that says your quizzes are graded, I'll also send you the solutions to the quizzes with the grading template that I used. So to be transparent, if you're angry, at least you know what you're angry about. Okay? But if you feel I've been unfair, don't take it out on the TAs. They have nothing to do with the grading. Okay? So it's not Nick's fault. It's not Umbrella's fault. You got to come talk to me. And if I've screwed up, I'll fix it. Hey, I've always believed that speedy, noisy feedback is better than slow, precise feedback. Because I remember giving quizzes in and exams in when I was a college student and not getting them back for 3 weeks. And by the time I got them back, I had no idea what I did. So I'd rather that you get it back sooner rather than later. And it'll be a lot sooner than you think. So watch for the email. I probably won't get this done by this evening because I have something to do this afternoon. But by tomorrow sometime, you will get the email and the quizzes should be ready to pick up. Okay, so that's it about the quizzes. I don't want to talk about the quiz. Actually, I do want to mention one thing about each problem. First, on problem one, you had two different regions, right? Two different countries. Which countries? Depends on your quiz. You had a U.S.-Mexico or a U.S.-Peru, and there were two separate quizzes, exactly identical in terms of how the problem is written, but the numbers are all different. So I hope and pray that none of you have given me the precise answer to the wrong problems, because that would be really tough to explain, of how you telepathically answered the peso problem on the Sewell quiz. It's not supposed to happen. So, but the first problem, the cash flows were all given in what currency? Dollar. So you either had to convert the discount rate into a dollar discount rate or the cash flows into the local currency. Either way, I'm okay. I'm even okay if you use the approximation. You know what I'm talking about, where there's a 4.5% difference or an 8.5% difference or a 7.5% difference. You took that difference out. Or you did the long way. Either way, it's okay as long as you matched up currencies. That's all the first problem is about. The second and the third problem were very simple variants of past quizzes, right? Essentially, I gave you a German company with operations in two other countries, and I asked you for a euro cost of equity, which means you've got to take a weighted average of the equity risk premiums and put them in. And your risk-free rate will always be what? The euro risk-free rate, which will be the German. So just this joint test of, do you get risk-free rates and can you get equity risk premiums? The third problem is a bottom-up beta problem. I gave you the two businesses. I gave you the unlevered beta. I gave you a way of converting revenues to sales. It's to get the weighted averages. The one little trick was I didn't give you the equity number, right? I gave you the debt number. But what did I tell you about the company? It's fairly priced relative to the peer group. What does that mean? When you estimate the values of the two businesses and you add them up, you get the total value of the company. So if I give you the debt, the rest has to be equity. There are only two ways you can raise money. That was the only tricky part. Don't worry, it's partial credit. I never saw that coming. You know, it's not the whole problem. And the last problem was really about whether you could read financial statements. Right? The only thing different about this problem than on the prior quiz is I gave you a statement of cash flows, which I almost never do. But a statement of cash flows is unique among the accounting statements because if you look at a statement of cash flows, there's no plus, plus, minus, minus. The cash flow carries that weight, right? So when I say capex, I don't have to say minus because the capex will be a negative number. So the only really tricky part about the final problem is what you did with working capital. You had a 50-50 shot. I hope you took the right 50-50 shot. Was it you're going to reduce your cash flow by it or increase it? Reduce it because it's a negative cash flow, which means it was an increase in working capital. It's kind of tricky, but that's the way it wasn't my trick, it was a statement of cash flows trick. Blame your accountants. And the other was what to do with acquisitions. I know we added a layer of discretion when we did this in class, right? When we said, when you project out cash flows, you have to make a judgment on whether acquisitions are part of the regular business or not. What made this problem simpler? I didn't ask you for a future free cash flow. I asked you for the free cash flow last year. Last year, there's no dancing around. You actually spent $10 billion, $10 million or $15 million on an acquisition. It's not a question of should I include it, should I not. Your cash flows were decreased by that amount. If I asked you to forecast these numbers, you can bring in, oh, you know what? For this company, it was a once-in-a-lifetime acquisition. It's done. But because it was last year's free cash flow, you're done. The other final point, I know the fourth problem, a few little quirks. You had to get taxes, right? And what do you apply the taxes on? You apply the taxes on your operating income, but the key is to make sure that you take your tax rate, which is, I think, 30% across both problems, and apply it on your operating income, not subtract the taxes paid. Collections of half points, that's what that problem is. So they basically, if you screwed up one, it's a half point. There are five little tricks I was looking for. Tricks is the wrong word. Techniques, strategic mistakes. Let's throw the word strategic in there. Okay? So that's basically it. As I said, I'll grade it, get it back to you as soon as I can. So today I want to continue with our discussion of growth. Last session we talked about historical growth, looking backwards. And I also ended that session by saying, knowing what your company grew at in the last 3 years, last 5 years, is kind of useless because it doesn't seem to give you much predictive power. In fact, I gave you the thesis title of that guy who wrote the thesis on can you predict future growth, and it was called Higgledy-Piggledy Growth. And I said, hey, you can't forecast growth. That doesn't mean you shouldn't look at past growth, but don't let your valuation be driven entirely by past growth. Today I want to turn to a second way of estimating growth, which is to outsource it. You're saying, I'm not the expert. There are people out there who track these companies every minute of every day. Let me just listen to them. And prominent among this group of so-called experts on your company are equity research analysts. Anybody here worked as a sell-side equity research analyst in your prior life? You don't even want to admit it anymore, right? But if you've been around a sell-side equity research analyst, the way sell-side equity research in the U.S. is constructed, and this is going to be critical in understanding how they work, is you're given 15 or 20 companies, and that is now your stable of companies for the rest of your life. Depressing thought. So if you're given the retail sector, you immerse yourself in that sector. The rest of the world stops existing as far as you're concerned. Your entire world is, what will Walmart do relative to Target? What will Target do relative to Amazon? Let me take that out. Many retail analysts, Amazon is not given to them because somebody more glorious usually gets Amazon. The tech guy says, Amazon is a tech company, it's mine. But you basically track 15 companies. Now, if you took the time equity research analysts spend and you break down the time into a pie chart and what they spend time on, A significant chunk of equity research analyst time is spent forecasting what next quarter's earnings per share is going to be. Now, don't pick on them for that. That's basically, so it's, will the next quarter's earnings be $2.67 or $2.65? And some of them actually also forecast long-term growth. In fact, there are services. One of the services called IBES, which basically, you know, surveys equity research analysts and asks them to give them the growth rates they're projecting for the next quarter and the next 5 years. So you go into Yahoo Finance or Zacks, you'll see a five-year growth rate given for your company. That five-year growth rate is a growth rate in earnings per share forecasted by equity research analysts tracking the company. A company like Apple can have as many as 60 equity research analysts forecasting growth. But here's something you want to remember. Out of the 60 equity research analysts, about 25% of them forecast five-year growth, the rest don't. So when IBES asks for the numbers, most analysts will give only one quarter, 1 year ahead. They don't even try the 5 year. So it's only a subset of analysts who forecast the five-year growth rate. But it should be a good growth rate, right? After all, they spend all their time with these companies. They know more about the sector than we do. And that's absolutely true. They do know details about the sector that you and I don't know and don't want to know. So they should get better estimates of growth, right? So let me start with that question. Are analysts' estimates of growth better than the estimates of growth you would get by just looking at historical data? That's a very simple test to beat, right? Because all I'm doing is taking a time series of earnings and saying, hey, let me use that to forecast next quarter's earnings. And I'll give you the good news and the bad news first. The good news first, and then I'll give you the bad news later. Studies that look at whether equity research analysts predict growth better than historical earnings models find that analysts do predict earnings a little better than historical earnings. So in other words, if I just took a time series model and projected our earnings next quarter, equity research analysts beat that. The way they measure that is they look at the error. In other words, if your forecasts are perfect, you should have zero error. You should be able to get the earnings per share right. Equity research analysts have smaller forecast error than historical earnings models. You think this is good news. The bad news is they're not that much better. Look at this, the improvement you're getting. So if you look at the analyst error versus the time series model, which is using historical earnings, you're getting about a 2 to 3% improvement in growth forecast by using analyst forecasts. And how many millions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars do we spend to get this minimal improvement? And if you break down that improvement, it turns out that that improvement is almost entirely in the one quarter ahead forecast, next quarter's forecast. And as you go further and further out into the future, it becomes almost non-existent. So when you look at a five-year earnings growth rate, you might as well have taken the five-year historical growth rate and used that as your growth rate in the next 5 years, because there seems to be almost no information in what analysts are forecasting on as a five-year growth rate. That's a puzzle, right? I mean, all this money, all this time, all these resources, all those insider tips coming to naught. So, in fact, I presented this to a symposium of equity research analysts, and they didn't like it. And they said, it's not us. I said, what do you mean it's not us? He said, we're the good equity research analysts, but there are a lot of bad analysts out there who are dragging the average down. Makes sense, right? Maybe the best analysts are all in New York and the bad analysts are in Florida and Iowa and Illinois or wherever else. He said, who's the best amongst you? And there's actually a group that gets labeled as the best analysts. You see, in football, in American football, they have an All-America team. Colleges do it, where essentially they take the best players from across the country and say, you're on the All-America team. They've borrowed that concept for equity research analysts. An institutional investor every year actually comes up with a group of analysts that they call All-America analysts. And if you're an equity research analyst, this is now the pinnacle of your life. From this day on, this gets attached to your name. So you say, I'm Joe Brown, All-America Equity Research Analyst. That's how you introduce yourself to your relatives, to your kids. In fact, you ask to be called All-America from this point on. So these must be the very best, right, to be labeled All. So there are studies that have looked at All-America analysts to see if their forecasts are much better than maybe the typical analysts. And there's some very puzzling results. In the year leading up to them being picked as All-America forecast, All-America analysts, There's no evidence that they're better. In fact, they're a little worse than the typical analyst in forecasting earnings. So institutional investor is not picking these analysts based on how well they predict earnings. So what are they picking them on? How do you become an All-America analyst? I'll give you a clue. If you get your name mentioned in the Wall Street, it's by votes. So if people don't recognize your name, they don't vote for you. So what do you have to do? You have to get your name out. And how do you get your name out? You say some incredibly stupid, obnoxious things, and the journal carries your name. That's better than not being noticed at all. Now do you see why when you read these market news stories, you sometimes see an analyst say things, that is a really stupid thing to say. I can't believe he said it or she said it. There's a reason for that. It's better to be mentioned than not mentioned. So an All-American analyst is really like selecting Kim Kardashian as the best actress in America. That's the only name you recognize. I give you 10 and I give you 9 obscure. It's like, Kim, I've heard of her. Yeah. But here's the mysterious thing. The year before, they're All-American analysts. There's no evidence. They're better than the rest. But the year after, they magically become a little better than the typical analyst. In fact, their forecast error is a little lower. It's about 2% lower than the typical analyst. So what do you think happens in the year after? Is it self-esteem? Is this a good, What do you think makes them better forecasters the year after they get picked as All-America analysts? Well, that's the price effect can be greater, but earnings forecast is not a market effect, right? Yeah. In fact, what did I say happens once you become an All-America analyst? You become Joe Brown, All-America Equity Research Analyst, right? So you call Cisco, the company you track, and you say, this is Joe Brown, All-America Equity Research Analyst on the phone. The CEO says, I'll get the CEO right now. He's in Vail, but he'll get to you right away. Why? Because they know that if you get mentioned. So what happens, man, I know this is all supposed to be on that gray area of access and no access, insider and outsider information. But the reality is your access improves. And the price effect also tends to go up. So after you become an All-America analyst, when you put out a buy recommendation, you get a bigger pop than when a typical analyst puts out a buy recommendation. When you put a sell recommendation, there's a much bigger drop than when a typical analyst puts a sell recommendation. But here's the follow-through. The buy recommendations, almost all of the pop disappears in the 6 months after. Sell recommendations, actually the effect persists. And again, don't read too much into it. What did I say? You have access to information. The company leaks out bad news about the company. You get it out. There's a sell recommendation. So essentially what it says, if you see an equity research analyst buy recommendation, you should trust it a lot less and give it less weight than you see a sell recommendation. The only problem is there are 7 to 8 times more buy recommendations than sell recommendations, right? So it doesn't seem like any subset of equity research analysts does better than the rest. I probably have 250 students from past years who work as sell-side equity research analysts around the world. So I have a personal stake in this. I worry about the state of sell-side equity research because it's clearly in trouble. In fact, I might have mentioned this, but J.P. Morgan about 6 months ago got somebody to write an artificial intelligence program which essentially read all the sell-side equity research reports, and then J.P. Morgan gave it a company in financials, and the computer actually wrote an equity research report on the company using the financials and all the words that it had read in previous. So basically, and then it gave, J.P. Morgan actually offered its actual equity research report and the artificial report to a portfolio manager. Say, can you tell which one is which? Portfolio managers have no idea. That's a scary thought, because what does it tell you? That the process has become so mechanized that if you could, this is like a James Patterson book. If you say this guy doesn't write his own books, he actually comes up with a storyline, which is half a paragraph. Somebody kills somebody, then the whole book is about, then somebody gets captured at the end. But he's made it, he's got the formula down, and he actually has a stable of people who write the book for him, which is fine. Right? In fact, just like that PhD student who wrote, who actually figured out a Danielle Steele formula and figured out a way to write a book exactly like her. Equity research analysts have become like Danielle Steele and James Patterson. They become completely predictable. So when I look at sell-side equity research, these, I think, are the five basic problems, and I'm not sure we can fix them. The first is what I call tunnel vision. You know where that comes from? When you became a sell-side equity research analyst, what did I tell you? You have 15 companies. Forget about the rest of the world. So if I gave you 15 social media companies right now to track, or 15 cloud computing companies, what do? You compare them to each other. The fact that you're paying 30 times revenues for a company in this sector might say, hey, you're getting a bargain. Look at these other companies out there. The tunnel vision comes about because you can't step back and look at your sector relative to the rest of the market. It's almost structured into the business. Second, there's a lot of lemmingitis. You know, the analysts often revise earnings estimates. The next time you see somebody revise an earnings estimate up or down, watch that company for the next 2 days, because what you're going to see is a bunch of other analysts also revising up or down their earnings report. There's a lot of lemmingitis, a lot of group movement. The third is what I call a variation of the Stockholm syndrome. You've heard of the Stockholm syndrome, right? This is where somebody who's kidnapped or taken hostage starts to identify with the hostage takers. After a while, it's like Paddy Hearst in the 1970s. I've actually seen equity research analysts use the word we when they talk about the company. We will do well. So who's we? Me and Tesla will do well. You've lost all objective thinking if you've become so caught up with the company and you like the man. It's tough not to do, because if you have 15 companies and you've been equity research analyst for 27 years, guess what? You know all these CEOs. You hang out with them. You play golf with them. You do whatever with them. And after all, it's very difficult to maintain that distance. And then there's that factophobia. I talked about stories and numbers, right? At the start, I have no problem with storytelling if it is disciplined and focused. You pick up some equity research reports. They're on 40 to 50 pages. And you read them, and you meander off into these tangents. It's like storytelling for the sake of storytelling. And finally, and this was a problem starting about 20 years ago, supposedly it's gone away. Is there equity research analysts who wear two hats? I call this the Jack Grubman effect. Jack Grubman in the early 1990s was an all-American analyst following the telecom sector for like 10 years in a row, one of the most prominent analysts on Wall Street. And he boasted in the Wall Street Journal in an article about the fact that he brought in hundreds of millions of dollars of investment banking business to Solomon every single year. I read the article and said, this guy's going to get fired. He's a sell-side equity research analyst. He's boasting about the fact that he's bringing in investment banking business, because you know what that means, right? You're following AT&T. AT&T has a banking relationship with the investment bank. You're saying, hey, I bring in investment. The way you bring it in is by giving AT&T recommendations or putting out recommendations in AT&T that you cannot justify based on the numbers. It still happens. It's been pushed to the background because a lot of investment banks got burned. So this is why, if you look at I hate getting emails from sell-side equity research analysts, because it'll be a two-line email. And then at the end, right after signature, will be two pages of non-disclosure things. There's a Chinese wall here. Don't worry about this. The fact that you're climbing up and down the Chinese wall doesn't really affect me. But you can see that there's a legal protection against it, but the reality is a lot of investment bankers cross the line constantly. It's a very depressing forecast for sell-side equity research, because unless I think we restructure this business, it's going to get to a point where people read a report and say, that's nice, but I don't care. And it might already have happened. So those are all facts to keep in mind. So here are some basic propositions about sell-side equity research. There's far less private information than you think in at least a typical U.S. equity research report. Maybe it's different in some emerging market with a loss or loser, but when I read a sell-side equity research report, there's almost no information there that I could not pick up on my own. Second, if there is information, the source of that information is what? It's a company. You're saying, so what? By definition, that is biased information. That's like a journalist whose primary source of information is a politician. He said, trust me, I'm going to be objective with this guy. You're going to get news, but it's going to be skewed. And third, if you think about valuing a company, it's nice. I'm not saying you should not look up what analysts are forecasting, but don't let that become the driver of your valuation. I'm going to tell you this, but I'll also predict in about 2 weeks or 3 weeks, when you sit down to do your DCF evaluation, a subset of you at least are going to email me saying, I'm coming up with a growth rate of 3% for my company. The equity research analysts are forecasting 15%. What should I do? And my advice is always the same. Go check out what the equity research analysts are forecasting. See if there's some substantial reason why they're coming up with a higher growth rate. If you cannot find that reason, stay with your growth rate. This is your valuation, and the only way you can claim ownership is by claiming that number. One more tangent. If we talk about people who know more about the company providing us with forecasts, and that's why we use equity research analysts, who knows even more than equity research analysts about a company? The who? The employees, but really, if you go ask the janitor at Cisco what's going on, but let's climb the ladder. It's the top management, right? You'd be amazed at how many evaluations I see where all of the forecasts come from who? Managers. These are wasted valuations. Because letting managers tell you what's going to happen for the next 10 years in terms of earnings growth and revenues and margins and reinvestment is going to essentially mean that you're coming up with these paper valuations reflecting management hopes. I'm not again saying don't listen to managers. Listen to them, take in what you think is useful, throw out the rest. Because they know far less about the future than they claim to know. They know a lot about the company, but they don't know about the economy, the market, the competition, and it's your job to make those judgments. So that's analyst forecasts. Let's turn to the third way to estimate growth. Ultimately, for a company to grow, it has to earn the growth. So let's do some basic algebra to see exactly what I'm talking about. Let's assume I have a company with $1 billion in earnings and it's making 12% right now on those earnings. So right now it's making $120 million. Next year, let's assume it invests $100 million in new projects and it continues to make 12%. Its earnings are going to go from $120 to $132 million. So if you ask me what the growth rate is, that's about a $12 increase, which is the $12 increase in earnings. It comes entirely from investment in new projects and what you make on those new investments. That's the insight that drives fundamental growth. That if you have stable return on capital, the only way you can grow is by adding to your capital, which is what reinvestment is, and the return you make on that invested capital. In fact, if you ask me to write it in terms of percentages, if I take the 100 million that I reinvested back, that's 100 right there, divided by the 120, which is the net income. So I'm dividing by the 120 and multiplying by the return on capital. That's, of course, what I reinvest. That's how well I reinvest. The product of those two numbers is my expected growth rate. It's as simple as that. If you tell me as a company how much you're reinvesting as a percentage of your income and how well you're reinvesting that money, the product of those two numbers is your expected growth rate. Do you see what I'm replacing my growth forecasting with? Instead of forecasting your growth, I'm going to forecast how much you reinvest and how well you reinvest. And if I can do that, I've in a sense forecast your growth. It forces your growth back into fundamentals. It makes you responsible for the growth. Now, how you define reinvestment and how well you reinvest is going to vary depending on what you're focused on. Let's start with the easiest one. Let's say you're focused on earnings per share. And you want to forecast growth in earnings per share. Your reinvestment is going to be the percentage of your earnings per share that you reinvest back into the company, which is whatever you don't pay out as dividends, right? So if you have a 60% payout ratio, 40% gets reinvested. And how well you reinvest, I'm going to capture with your return on equity. You see how I'm staying, because it's earnings per share, equity earnings, I'm staying focused on measuring reinvestment as a percentage of earnings per share, and your return on equity becomes how well you reinvest. But let me ask you a question. Take the example I gave you. You have $100 in earnings. You pay out $60 in dividends. Was my payout ratio 60% or 40%? I forget, whatever it was. Okay. So let's say I pay out $60 in dividends. In the first approach, I'm claiming $40 is getting reinvested, right? But is it? When I don't pay out dividends, does it go back into projects that make the 12% or 15%? What is it? What else can it go into? Well, let's assume the share buybacks are also included in the dividends. Let's say that our dividends are counted, so we count any cash return. It could be going to cash, right? You see where I'm going next? If I'm an Apple and I know what your retention ratio is, I can't assume that that money is getting reinvested in smartphones and computers, because a big chunk of that money is getting reinvested in cash, earning an abysmally low rate of return. So in the second approach, rather than focus on total earnings, which includes the earnings from cash, I separate the net income into two parts. Net income from cash, which I'm going to keep separate, because it's a very different beast, and net income from non-cash assets. I'm going to measure reinvestment the conventional way. What are you putting into projects? Rather than just taking your word for, I took 40% and put it into my company, what are you putting into projects measured as the difference in capital expenditures and depreciation? And how much are you putting into short-term assets and working capital? I'm going to take that and net out the debt that I take. Why net out the debt? Because I'm an equity investor. If 40% of this comes from lenders, the remaining 60% has to come from me. So I'm essentially replacing my retention ratio, which is just what I put back into the company, with what I actually reinvest in projects and working capital. That I call an equity reinvestment rate. Okay? And when I measure returns now, I'm going to measure a non-cash return on equity. You're saying, what the heck is that? I take the cash income from net income out of the numerator. And then in my denominator, instead of dividing by book equity, I divide by book equity minus cash. And be ready for some very unpleasant things to start happening. When I take Apple and I do this, you know what happens to my non-cash return on equity? How much cash do they have? $200 billion. Their book equity is $120 billion. Houston, we have a problem. Right? What do you do then? You throw up your hands and say, I don't know what the return equity is. It's a very, very high number. The approach will break down, but we'll talk about what to do next. But non-cash return equity times equity reinvestment rate is the expected growth in non-cash net income. And finally, if I'm looking at operating income, I'm going to define reinvestment not as a percentage of net income, but as a percentage of after-tax operating income. That's EBIT times 1 minus D that you got in problem 4 will now become the denominator. And in the numerator, you will have net capex and change in working capital. And because this is the entire firm, I no longer consider debt. So that becomes my reinvestment rate. And when I measure returns, I'm going to measure return on invested capital. What is that? That's the after-tax operating income again in the numerator. And in the denominator, instead of just looking at book equity, I look at book equity plus book debt minus cash. This is the only place in finance where we pay homage to book value. Everywhere else, we use market values. When we do return on equity and return on capital, we use book value because we want to get a measure of what you've actually invested in existing projects. Now, very quickly, before we look at the contrast between these numbers, let's start with the retention ratio. Retention ratio is whatever net income you pay out, whatever you don't pay out in dividends. So what's a maximum retention ratio you can have? 100%. So retention ratios are maxed out at 100% and they're floored at 0%. You think, so what? Equity reinvestment rates and regular reinvestment rates. What's the minimum you can get? Can they go below zero? That's my question. Look at the numerator. What do you have? Net capex, change in working capital. Net capex is capex minus depreciation. Change in working capital is if it's an increase or a decrease. You could actually get a negative reinvestment rate in a year that the company is shrinking its capital invested. Your reinvestment rates can be negative. They're not floored at zero. Can your reinvestment rate be greater than 100%? Sure. And when you tell me the reinvestment rate is greater than 100%, what are you telling me you're going to be doing that year? You're either borrowing or raising new equity, raising new capital. So that's the first thing to remember. If I'm staying with retention ratio, the number's between 0 and 1, but reinvestment rates can be negative, they can be positive. They give you much more freedom, and you need them. You know when? When you have a young startup, you will have reinvestment rates that exceed 100%. When you have a declining company, you will have a reinvestment rate that's negative because the company is shrinking over time. So it gives you more freedom to look at much broader, you know, ranges of companies. And But the fundamental principle remains the same no matter which of these three equations you use. So let's start with growth in earnings per share. Growth in earnings per share, we said, is retention ratio times return on equity. Retention ratio is maxed out at 100%, floored at 0%. So if you believe this equation, I'm actually giving you a cap on growth in earnings per share in the long term, right? Your earnings per share growth cannot exceed your return on equity. So if you have a return on equity of 12%, over the long term, you cannot grow faster than 12% if you're thinking about... You're saying, why can't my retention ratio be greater than 100? This is a per share number, so I can't count in new equity that I'm raising as a way of growing. So the expected growth cannot be greater than the return equity. It's actually a very useful starting equation, but for many people, when they talk about sustainable growth, this is the equation they're generally talking about. So get familiar with it, even though it's a very, very specific version of the equation, retention ratio times return equity. So let's take a company. I took Wells Fargo in 2008, pre-crisis. And there's a reason why I'm going to go pre-crisis, post-crisis, so you can see how your expected growth rate will change. If you look at pre-crisis, the banks had been doing really well for 5 years. Wells Fargo's return on equity, based on its 2008 earnings, which looked really good, was 17.56%. It was paying out about 45.37%. It was retaining about 45.37% of its earnings, which means it's paying out about 54.63%. Let's say you're sitting down to value Wells Fargo in August of 2008. You have these numbers in front of you. In a moment of weakness, you decide that this is the way the world's going to be for the future. And you say, I'm going to estimate growth for Wells Fargo. Almost trivial, right? 45.37% times 17.56% gives me an expected growth rate of 8%. So in August of 2008, if you'd valued Wells Fargo, you'd have valued using an 8% growth in earnings per share, a 54% payout ratio, and a 17.56% return on equity. But these numbers are fragile, and September of 2008 showed us how fragile they were. Post-2008, let's say it's October of 2008, your net income is still the same number you had before the crisis because no new numbers have come out, but you know the world has changed under you. Let's assume that you think that because of this crisis now, regulatory capital requirements will be raised. You know what I'm talking about, right? Banks are governed by regulatory capital requirements. Now there's a crisis, you're saying the Fed's going to raise those. In the case of banks, when we talk about regulatory capital, we're talking about a variant of book equity. Because banks don't think of debt as capital, it's all equity. So what am I saying? Even though you might have the same net income now, from this point on, to grow, you will need 30% more book equity than you did before. So even though no new numbers have come out about the bank, here's what's going to change. To get my return equity now, what am I going to do? I'll have this. Let's keep the $17.56 I had as net income before in the numerator. But in my denominator, what am I going to have as my book equity? It used to be 100, but now I'll use 130. That's going to lower my return equity from 17.56 to about 14%. You already see that. Just by changing that, what are you going to do? That lower return equity is going to translate into much lower growth in earnings per share. And you can work it out. I think it works out to 5% rather than 8%. And that's what crises do to bank valuations, is they essentially push them down because your return equity going forward is going to be much lower than it was historically. So for those of you working with financial service companies, that is why you need to pay attention to regulatory capital. It's not some side story. It's going to be central in determining your future return equity. And that future return equity is going to determine whether you will trade it above book value, at book value, or below book value. And we'll come back and talk about this in more detail when we value Wells Fargo later on. But you can already see how changes in regulatory capital can change your perceptions of future return equity. Any questions? Yes?
How could a cyclical company value?
Do the common sense thing. What's the problem with cyclical companies? Is your earnings the numerator, right? It's not the denominator. The earnings go up and down. When any number goes up and down without a trend, what should you do? Average it out. You're done. So rather than use last year's return equity, what would you do? You'd average out. Easier said than done with an oil company, because what do you now have to decide? You have ups and downs and ups and downs, but between 2002 and 2012, you had ups and downs with this upward trend line. you have to ask yourself whether you're going to go back to a pre-2002 oil price, in which case you'll be normalizing. So normalization with commodity companies becomes a little messier. With cyclical companies, if all you have is the economy, just average out across the cycle. So return on equity is the key to high growth in earnings per share, right? So if you have a high return on equity, you have high growth in earnings per share. Now, there are two ways you can end up with a high return on equity. One is to take great projects. But that's so difficult. The other is to take average projects and pump them up. With what? With debt. And here's why. You can actually decompose the return equity into two components. There's what you make on your projects. Let's call that return on capital. And there's a leverage effect. And what's the leverage effect? Let's say you make 10% on your projects. And you pay 5% as your interest rate on your debt. And let's add on top of that that you get a 40% tax benefit on interest. So the 5% interest rate becomes a 3% interest rate after taxes. You're making 10% on your project. So if you're the equity investor in this company, you actually, for every dollar that you borrow, keep the 7 cents. I know it sounds too good to be true. And there is actually a catch in this process. But if you're the equity investor, the more you borrow, the higher your expected return on equity will become. Real estate investors have milked this for ages, right? That's why real estate is this hugely levered business. Because real estate by itself is a pretty boring average return business, but by using enough debt, you can pump up the return equity. So the key, though, is what are you borrowing at? What kind of tax benefit? To show you how much pumping up I can do, incidentally, while you do these calculations, because we're still focused on book value, use a book value debt to equity. So this is, again, one of the few places where you're going to stick with book values because you're interested in a book value denominator. So let me take an example. This was way back in time, in 1998. I was valuing a company that was then called Brahma. It's now called Ambev, and it's changed, but it's at that time it was a Brazilian beverage company. Now it's a Latin American beverage giant owned by Ambev, which wants to kind of own the rest of the beer, you know. So basically, it's now a very different company. But I remember this is the first time I was going to Brazil. This is the first Brazilian company I ever valued. And I looked at the return equity, and I was dazzled. It was about 31%. So, okay, let me take a look at why it's... So first, I computed the return on capital, where essentially you take the after-tax operating income invested capital. And actually, they're taking some really good projects. 19.91% was the return on capital with no debt. But they also had, for every dollar of equity, 77 cents in debt. And they were paying about 5.61% after taxes on that debt, which means that for every dollar that they borrowed, they got to keep about $13.50. The net effect of that is as they borrowed, the return equity went up. So this is great, right? So if you're an equity investor, you should just pump up your debt, push up your return equity. Your growth in earnings per share will always go up. What's the catch, though? This is equity. So basically, return equity will go up, growth in earnings per share, but then when you compute the cash flows to equity, it'll have the higher growth. But then you have to discount those cash flows at a cost of equity, which will now be pushed up. That same leverage. It's the same story we were talking about, right? The free cash flow to equity. Your growth in earnings per share and your return equity will always look better in good times with more debt. But there will be bad times. One final example, and then we'll end for the day. I grew up in a city called Chennai, and I go back about once a year. I mean, I've been away for 36 years, so the only people I know in Chennai are my own family, and even they sometimes don't recognize me when I come. But somehow news gets around that I'm coming home, and the fatted calf has gotten ready. Actually, not. No, you can't kill a fatted calf in India. But you get the analogy. So, but somehow, people find out, they say, will you come in and talk to our company about valuation? Because it's a free resource. I'm in the city. I can't say no. And many of these people I knew when I was a little kid, so I can't say no. So this was when my uncle was the CEO of a company called Titan Watches, pretty well-known Indian watch company. And somebody in the company had read about using debt to borrow money, and they kept borrowing money, and the return equity kept going down. So he said, can you come in and take a look at what's going on? Tell us why this magic is not working. So I worked through some numbers. I came up with a return on capital of 9.54%. Not bad. The debt-to-equity ratio was 191%. This guy was just going crazy in the finance office, saying, debt, I'll push up debt. But this was in the days when rupee risk-free rates were 10, 11, 12%. The cost, after-tax cost of debt for the company is 10.125%. So basically what were they doing? They were borrowing money at 10.125%, taking projects that made 9.54% and wondering why things weren't adding up. So let that be a caveat. If you're making less than your after-tax cost of debt, borrowing money will actually hurt you. It won't help you. It's unusual, but it can happen. So on that note, let's finish for the day. On Wednesday, we'll finish the rest of growth and go into terminal value.
Because you almost have to second guess. No activist investor second guesses the mantra. They just go on. So you need a second guessing mechanism where you say, that guy will do this, therefore I'm